Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI urges the faithful to renew and strengthen their relationship with God during this Lenten season. Anglican Father Michael Lapsley tells his story of loss, survival and renewal, and of how he travels the world bringing inspiration and witness, because we are all in need of healing. The girl with the dragon tattoo has just walked home with a coveted Oscar statuette for Best Film Editing. Peter Malone gives us his thoughts about the film. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday reminded the faithful that the season of Lent is a time to renew and strengthen our relationship with God. Speaking to pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square for the Angelus prayer, the Pope spoke of daily acts of prayer, penitence and charity, which must accompany us on our Lenten journey. Lent is a time when Christians join together to face their own sinfulness and need of repentance. It's a time to turn away from those things which deny life, like war, fear, poverty, and to turn to those things that are life-giving, like peace, justice, and service to others. A while ago, I was given the opportunity to speak to someone whose story speaks of just that, life-giving peace and forgiveness and service to others. And I would add, respectful listening, emotional and spiritual healing, social healing, reconciliation, learning from the past, peace-building and restorative justice. He is Anglican Father Michael Lapsley, founder of the Institute for Healing Memories, that seeks to accompany other people on their journeys to healing and wholeness, both in South Africa, where it is based, and in many other countries where war, oppression and conflict have created suffering. I met Father Lapsley at the American University of Rome, where he had been invited to deliver a lecture on young people and peace. And as I usually do when I sit down for an interview, I asked him to tell me a little about himself and what brought him here.
Well, I was born and brought up in New Zealand. I went to Australia to train to be a priest and to become a member of an Anglican religious order. And my community transferred me to South Africa in 1973. And I often say the day I arrived in South Africa, I stopped being a human being and became a white man. And I realized that I would need to become part of the liberation struggle if I was going to recover my own humanity in solidarity with black people struggling for their fundamental human rights in the land of their birth. I was a student in South Africa. I became a chaplain to three university campuses, two black and one white. In 1976, I was the national chaplain of Anglican students, which, of course, was the time of the Soweto uprising when many young people were imprisoned, tortured, killed, detained, and very large numbers went into exile. Shortly after that, I was expelled from South Africa, and I went to live in Lesotho, which, of course, is a small African country totally surrounded by South Africa. And it was there that I approached the African National Congress to become a member. And I realized that apartheid would not be ended by individual actions. It had to be by collective discipline, struggles of many people acting in concert that would eventually bring apartheid down. So I was to spend the next 16 years with the people living in exile, first in Lesotho, subsequently in Zimbabwe.
It was during those years of exile that his mission to be part of the struggle for justice caused him to travel the world with a message of hope.
Whilst I lived in Southern Africa, I travelled the world as part of the struggle against apartheid. And I suppose my message across the world at that time was simply to say that apartheid was a choice or an option for death. carried out in the name of the gospel of life. I think for me what was particularly outrageous is that the apartheid state claimed to be Christian, claimed divine guidance. But apartheid said the most important thing about us is the color of our skin, where the gospel asserts that we all have infinite dignity and value because we're children of God. So they both can't be true. One had to be a lie. So my work was seeking to mobilize the faith community against apartheid across the world.
But while he was in Zimbabwe, something terrible happened to him, something that forced him to find resources within himself and his faith, and ultimately lead him to undertake his own personal journey of healing, forgiveness, and renewal.
In April of 1990, 3 months after the release of Mandela, I received a letter bomb, and in the process lost both hands and eye, eardrums were shattered, and many other injuries. And yet somehow I felt that God was with me, present in my suffering. I always felt that Mary, who watched her son being crucified, understood what it was that I was going through. A little bit of the time, I thought it would be better to be dead. I had never met someone with no hands, so I couldn't imagine what life would be like. But because of the years of traveling across the world, when I was bombed, there were messages of prayer, love, support. And that was what enabled me to make my bombing redemptive, to bring life out of death, good out of evil. I realized that if I was filled with hatred, bitterness, self-pity, desire for revenge, that I would be a victim forever. They would have failed to kill the body, but they would have killed the soul. So I was enabled to travel a journey beyond being a victim, beyond simply being a survivor, to become a victor, and to move, if you like, from being an object of history to becoming a subject of history once more. And I realized that the peoples of the world had accompanied me on my own journey of healing. And now it was time for me to return the compliment and begin the work of accompanying others on their journey of healing.
A long and painful recovery process, marked by moments of despair, reinforced Father Michael's determination to carry on fighting for justice and equality.
Now, when I returned to South Africa in 1992 to live, I realized that for millions of South Africans, unlike me, their stories had not been acknowledged and reverenced and recognized. People had not said what happened to you was wrong. And that led me with others to set up a process, an experiential workshop in particular, which we called a Healing of Memories workshop. And so my work has been very much about creating safe and sacred spaces where people could explore how the nation's journey had affected them psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, so that people could remember and yet not be controlled by their memories, not be prisoners of their memories, to find ways that people could, if you like, detoxify from the poison which is often connected to terrible memories. And by poison, I mean things like hatred and bitterness.
I read somewhere that you said that you felt you could be a better priest without hands than if you had had hands. Do you mean that people need a witness, need a figure to be able to understand and to be able to go ahead?
I'm not sure that so much people need, but they can identify with someone whom they see in front of them, who clearly knows suffering and pain and loss and sacrifice. So they know, without you having said a word, that at a very profound level, that there will be an understanding and appreciation. And I've come to see that pain is transcendent. And so I can be in a context where people are incredibly different in terms of their history, their appearance, their culture, but it's in the sharing of pain that we begin to connect to one another.
It reminds me of words I've heard from war veterans. They spoke to me of this incredible bonding that they had in moments of pain and fear. It's obviously something that can be transforming.
There's a great sense of solidarity, but what is of course also true of individuals, communities and nations, that often after terrible experiences, society moves on. but leaves small or very large groups of victims without having had their pain acknowledged. And people often hold on to their victimhood, waiting for them to be acknowledged. If you think, you know, of the so-called comfort women in Korea, who still today, women in their 80s and 90s, are still demonstrating and saying to the Japanese, please acknowledge what it is that happened to us. And you can think of many, many examples around the world. And of course, we're here in Rome, and there has been the importance of some of the acknowledgement by the Holy Father of pain which was caused by the church to people. Of course, that needs to continue and extend, but acknowledgement can be the first step in the journey of healing.
Yes, as Father Michael points out, acknowledgement can be the first step in the journey of healing, just as every story, he says, needs a listener.
Well, you were also part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which did create the possibility for South Africa to go forward.
I came to the conclusion myself that South Africa proceeded on into the future based on two pillars. One was the need to meet the basic needs of the people for water, electricity, education, healthcare, all of those things, which we'll be seized with still for a very long time to come. But the other pillar was dealing with the past, dealing with what we have done to one another. And our Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a giant step along that road of facing the truth of what we had done to each other. And the commission was, in a way, like creating a huge mirror and putting it in front of a nation and saying, let's look into this mirror, let's see what it is that we have done to one another, because only by looking fully at it would we be able to begin to let it go. But I also realized that only a limited number of people would come to this commission. In fact, 23,000 people came and told their stories. 88,000 people came and asked for amnesty. But we're a country of 45 million. And so some of us said we need to create other safe and sacred spaces where any South African who wished to would be able to deal with how the nation's past had affected them. And that was really the thinking that lay behind what is today the Institute for Healing of Memories.
And today, he explains, the Institute for Healing of Memories takes that belief a step further by acknowledging the importance of forgiveness, reconciliation, and restorative justice in a whole range of situations.
In today's South African context, as well as working for national reconciliation, we work with refugees, especially refugee women. We work with people affected, infected by HIV and AIDS. We work with prisoners, recognizing as well that often those who do terrible things to others have had terrible things done to them. And so it's this question of how do we break the cycle that turns victims into victimizers.
I noticed actually a quote from your website. You say, all people are capable of being perpetrators or victims, and sometimes both.
Yes, I think as human beings, we tend to recognize our victimhood, but we're often blind to the ways in which we can at the same time be perpetrators. And of course, facing myself as a perpetrator means I've got to deal with emotions like guilt and shame. And that is why individuals and indeed whole nations go into denial about what happened, because to face it is to face very uncomfortable feelings. And yet when we do face them, it's like the surgeon's knife. It can be extremely painful, but it can bring healing and certainly steps along the road to healing.
As I mentioned at the beginning, I was given the opportunity to meet and to speak with Father Lapsley here in Rome, where he had been invited by the American University of Rome to give a talk entitled Young People and the Art of Peace, together with the South African ambassador to Italy.
You're here today, Father Lapsley, to talk about young people and the art of peace.
I think there's this connection between the facing of the past and the creating of the future. And it is young people who hold the key to that. And I hope that my own presence and what I say may provide encouragement and inspiration to young people to say that history is created by all of us, and we can either choose to live selfish lives committed only to greed or power or privilege, or we can say we in our own lives will seek to make the world kinder, gentler, more just. And of course, part of that, and part of the creation of peace, is the creation of friendship across many lines. I think there's some urgency here in Europe, where there is growing xenophobia, growing Islamophobia, to begin a new dialogue about how the other is also us. There is no other really. We are indeed one human family. And so I think young people, when they travel, when they go to visit other countries, create friendship, and also see the pain that often exists, I think all of that, if you like, incentivizes and inspires young people then to come back in this context and to work for social justice. Because I think I think it was Pope Paul VI who said, if you want peace, work for justice. And that's an underlying theme of what I would hope to share. But I would also want today to share something of my own life journey, of the choices I made, and encourage young people to think about their own life choices.
It's hard in this very materialistic world sometimes to try and pass on this responsibility almost to young people, isn't it?
I think we live in this acquisitive society, and we're all attracted by things, but I think there are also signs among young people of a recognition that that alone cannot satisfy, because we all need connection to other human beings to live meaningful and fruitful lives. And I think young people are quick to see if someone is fake or whether they're real, and also as human beings, we have our deepest needs, our deepest longings are about connection and belonging and meaning. So I think that hopefully I can speak to those. And if you like, find the echoes in the hearts of those who will be speaking to and interacting with. And to see that the more we create friendship across the world, the more meaningful our own lives become, the more we struggle for justice. We don't only give, but we also gain hugely. We end up with lives of deep satisfaction, which the materialistic option can never satisfy our deepest needs. And of course, it just encourages us to want to acquire more and more. And I think Catholic social teaching has spoken to this with great depth and consideration over many years, and inspired many people who themselves are not Roman Catholics, but see in that body of social teaching encouragement to life values.
There were so many things I wanted to ask Father Lapsley, also because he comes from the part of the world closest to me, my feelings and my interests. So I couldn't resist a mention of our long-suffering neighbour, Zimbabwe.
You yourself mentioned one human family. You said we're one human family, which was the theme of Pope Benedict's message for refugees last year. You live in South Africa, across the border. There is Zimbabwe, and we follow what's going on there, and we ask ourselves, is there anything we must do, that we should do? What is your view for the future of Zimbabwe? What do you hope?
Zimbabwe is a beautiful nation with very wonderful people, but who are going through terrible pain. I think it was Lord Acton that said that power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we can see that in many contexts of the world, when the pursuit of power by an individual and a tiny clique holding on to it can cause immense pain to a people. My own church, the Anglican Church, is at present being severely persecuted by the Mugabe regime. For me, a source of pain is that the ecumenical family in Zimbabwe has not been as supportive as it might be, and I think there is a call to people who are not Anglicans. It's really a bit like, the story of, Nazism. They came for the Jews, but I was not a Jew. They came for, and that whole list of people. And I think then that there is a desperate need for ecumenical solidarity in Zimbabwe, which we're not seeing. There are some individual examples, but it's not as clear as it should be. But there are also fundamental human rights issues there in Zimbabwe. I mean, we in South Africa have millions of Zimbabweans there. So we need assistance as a country to be able, because we also have our own, as in Europe, our own xenophobic tendencies. And I think that the antidote if you like, to xenophobia is always international solidarity. And I think for us as Christians, thinking particularly about refugees, we need to remember that Jesus was a refugee on the continent of Africa. And if we are followers of Jesus, we need to have the welfare and the rights of refugees very close to our hearts.
Another subject I could not resist is Nelson Mandela. I had read on a website that, speaking of Father Lapsley, Mandela himself said, "Michael's life represents a compelling metaphor, a foreigner who came to our country and was transformed. His life," Mandela said, "is part of the tapestry of the many long journeys and struggles of our people."
You met Nelson Mandela. I know he's spoken of you. Can you tell me something about him?
Well, I suppose in a way, Nelson Mandela is an extraordinary human being, but he's also an embodiment of the best of South Africa. He was a product of our struggle. He not only led it, he embodied the best in us. I suppose what I have seen in Nelson Mandela, and I think increasingly the peoples of the world have seen, is a giant who sacrificed his life not for his own, for himself, but for others. So I think he has inspired me through much of my life, and profound honor that I've had the opportunity to meet him on a number of occasions.
A profound honor, I have no doubt. And for me, it was certainly a great honor to be able to meet and to speak with Father Michael Lapsley, a powerful witness of man's capacity, against all odds, to survive, forgive, and find the way of peace and reconciliation, and ultimately help others do the same. Oscar night has come and gone, and the Scandinavian film The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo has just walked home with a coveted statuette for best film editing. But as for the story itself, Vatican Radio's film critic Peter Malone explains it follows closely the work it is based on, Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy, which has really reached a vast number of readers. I asked him if he liked the film version, which he says has much appeal of its own.
I did like it. This is the second version of it. I don't know whether you saw the earlier one made in Sweden itself, where the story is set. It's part of a trilogy by Stieg Larsson, which apparently everybody around the world was reading, although I seem to have missed out on it.
Well, but, me too, Peter.
It's the Millennium Trilogy, and Millennium is a magazine in Stockholm that deals in investigative journalism. And not the central character, the second central character, is actually guilty, found guilty in the courts, of libeling an industrialist.
The last time I reported on something without being absolutely sure, I lost my life savings.
I need a reception. And so he's got nothing to do, and he's invited to a rich family who've been very strong in companies in Sweden, and they have a mystery dating back to the 60s, and he's asked to investigate it.
I need your help. You come stay on the island. A way of avoiding all those people you might want to avoid right now.
And well, you might ask, how does the girl with the dragon tattoo come into it? She actually is quite a punk-looking young woman who's been in institutions, who's actually been responsible for the burning of her father, who was very brutal towards her. But she's a whiz in information technology, and she's been invited to investigate the journalist himself.
She's one of the best investigators I have.
But?
She's different.
In what way?
In every way.
And about halfway through the film, these two stories come together, and she helps him with his investigation.
Can I call you Elizabeth? I want you to help me catch a killer of women.
And yes, it's quite a mystery, but it's also, I think, an interesting look at Swedish society and the secrets of the past, especially wartime, anti-Semitism, quite a lot of cruelty and sexual sadism as well.
Rape, torture, fire, animals, religion. Am I missing anything?
The names.
I had a look, as usual, at the trailer and I read up about it a little bit, and it looks like the kind of film that really draws you in.
It does. It runs for 2.5 hours, as did the original. So, yes, you have to pay attention. So I think I found this American version, although it was made in Sweden as well, either easier to follow or, because I had seen the earlier one, I knew a lot of what was going to happen.
This is Harriet. Someone in the family murdered Harriet. And for the past 40 years, has been trying to drive me insane.
And they keep fairly close to the book, so my brother tells me, and I think that there are very few differences. But an interesting cast and very well made for cinema. The first one, I think, was made more for television.
Well, it's directed by David Fincher, who's done some very good work. The Social Network really stands out, but he's done some other good films as well.
Interestingly, the young girl who appears at the beginning of The Social Network is the one he chose for the girl with the dragon tattoo, so...
He's clean, in my opinion. He's honest.
As they say, it's a breakthrough performance from her, and I presume she's going to have a successful career after portraying this very enigmatic, controlling, odd, interesting woman.
It's the kind of film that I feel like going to see because of the tension in it, because of the curiosity of finding out what really is at the bottom of this mysterious story.
Yes, and there are a couple of twists at the end which take you in interesting directions. I presume, as they did in Sweden, they're going to film the other two books from the Millennium Trilogy, which actually focus more on her story. It takes us back into her past with her relationship with her father and other investigations. This one is, in a sense, a standalone story, but it keeps interesting. I was going to say Daniel Craig is in it, having some time off from James Bond, I suppose.
It's Mikael Blomqvist. May I come in?
But he's a tough kind of character, whereas the man in the Swedish film was quite a gentleman. So it's a different dynamic between the two investigators.
Other...
As I said, lots of strange characters in the family they're investigating.
You will be investigating thieves, misers, bullies, the most detestable collection of people that you will ever meet. My family.
Yeah, it looks like a pretty difficult family. But other characters in the film, actors in the film that stand out are definitely Christopher Plummer.
You have a very keen investigative mind.
And Robin Wright, I see.
Yes. Christopher Plummer is the patriarch of the family that he wants the investigation. And Robin Wright, who along with Rooney Mara, the girl with the dragon tattoo, are the only two Americans in this American remake. Robin Wright's the editor of the magazine. So while it's an American production, and somebody said they had to do it because Americans don't read subtitles, well, that may be, it's very much a Scandinavian-British film. A lot of British cast, including Jolie Richardson, Vanessa Redgrave's daughter.
And we can hear that also in the accent of the actors as they speak.
Actually, Daniel Craig and Robin Wright and Rooney Mara are all... They've all got a kind of European inflection to their voice. It's not obtrusive, but they're not speaking with their plain British or American accents. So it's kept the atmosphere of the country of origin.
That's all from the English Feature Programme and from me, Linda Bordoni, today. But we will be back at the same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English Programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.